If I could get your attention, we'll get started. Got a lot of territory to cover today. We are, as you've probably guessed if you haven't been here, we're studying the book of Exodus, and this is our fifth lesson in a series of 10 lessons. If you hadn't put all 10 on your calendar yet, I believe November 11th is our last 10th final lesson. And last week, we saw all the plagues of it that God brought upon Egypt that caused them to finally be agreeable to letting the people of Israel go. And so now we're going to find the people in Exodus 14 desperately needing the salvation of the Lord. They need a miraculous salvation at the Red Sea, just like a Kramer's friend in this movie clip. All right. So last week, the mighty acts of God, they gave us the proof of presence of the living God. He exists, and He's the only one true God. And we know this was God's purpose statement to prove that. We saw it repetitively in each chapter. After every miracle, we were told the purpose statement, that you may know that I alone am God. That's what this is all about. And so all the pantheon, you know, Egypt had a God for everything. God for the river and the moon and the sun and the stars and all the different animals and the fertility and, you know, on and on and on. A pantheon of gods. They were all defeated, crushed by the God of Israel. And so we should come to the inescapable conclusion, there is just one God, and He is all powerful. Therefore, there's just one truth, one way, one God. And that's the whole point of this, really, is God revealing Himself to Israel and Egypt and the whole world. So if you look at the progression of this self-disclosure of God throughout the book of Exodus, for what we've already studied and what we're going to study, you start off with the burning bush. You know, God appears in the glory of God in the burning bush that doesn't burn up, speaks to Moses, gives him his call and commission. And then last week, the 10 miracles, the awesome miracles that God does. And then this week you'll see that God leads them. He lets them see His presence in the pillar of cloud. And then at night, that's during the day, and then at night they see the glory of God called the Shekinah glory in the cloud that leads them at night so they can see Him also at night. So He's leading them. And then also, of course, the Red Sea crossing miracle that we're going to look at here in a minute. In chapter 14, and then after they cross the Red Sea, they're in the desert. If you've ever driven through that Sinai desert, I mean, I don't know how anything lives there. I don't know how a snake or a lizard or anything could live in there. And so the next question is going to be, well, how can they possibly live? Where are they going to get food and water? And God is going to provide manna from heaven, the bread, the heavenly bread from God, and big flocks of quail are going to come through there for the meat, and they're going to get water miraculously as well. And then sixthly, we'll see when they get to Mount Sinai, which is where they're headed, God will reveal Himself. They will see His glory and feel His presence and hear His voice there at Mount Sinai. And so I would say that it's clear in the book of Exodus, after all that progression of God's self-disclosure, there are no atheists in Israel. You know, after all that, they know that there's a God and they know who He is. And so that's kind of the purpose statement all through these miracles. And last week, the last miracle, the 10th miracle, was what we get the idea of Passover, or the feast of Passover that Israel still celebrates, came from that 10th miracle. Because we're told in chapter 12, verse 13, God said for all of Israel to put the blood of the lamb on the doorpost. And He said, when the angel of death comes, I will see the blood and pass over your house. And so imagine the terror in Egypt, the fear and the aftermath of what's going to happen. Because in the 10th plague, because at midnight, this unwanted visitor, the angel of death, came to all the homes in Egypt, with the exception of the Israelite homes who had the blood on the doors. He was looking for that when he came. He was the angel of death. He's on a mission from God, and he's going to kill the firstborn of every home in Egypt. Now, you may want to say, wow, that's kind of ruthless. That's kind of unmerciful. That's kind of harsh. Don't forget what Pharaoh had commanded in chapter 1. You remember? Kill all of the Israelite firstborn boys. Kill them. So they threw them in the river, right? And they drowned them. And so now, not only are we seeing this payback, you might say, as one of the miracles that finally releases Israel, but also in today's lesson, when God causes the sea to come back on the Egyptian army and they all drown, you're going to go, wow, they tried to wipe out Israel by drowning all their children, and now the entire Egyptian army is going to be drowned. So it's actually exactly what they deserve. It's justice. And we should know that. And so the angel of death comes through, inspects each door for that blood, and only on the door of the Israelite homes where there is blood does he pass over, goes right by them. The other homes, the Egyptian homes, he goes in and takes the life of the firstborn child. And so he traveled up and down the Nile River claiming all these lives. And we can see, pick it up in chapter 12, verse 29. Exodus 12, 29. Now it came at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh. So there was no class distinction. The king was not exempt. He got Pharaoh's son as well as everybody else's. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn, even the animals, he took all them out. And Pharaoh, boy, have we got his attention now. He finally arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. So all the wailing and crying and weeping in Egypt over this last miracle. And so he and all his servants cried out for grief and fear of what had just happened. And even now, in verse 31 through 33, even though Pharaoh had previously said, I'll never let my slaves who are doing all the work, Israel, I'll never let them go. But now, in verse 31 through 33, what does he do? He orders them. He orders them to go. Look what he says. Verse 31. He says, basically, get up, get out, and go. Leave here in a hurry. Why? Because it says there, and all the Egyptians said this, if they don't leave, we shall all be dead. So they realized what God was doing, and all these plagues had come upon them because they wouldn't let Israel go. Now they realize the faster we get these people out of here, the better off we'll be. And so there was an urgency about it. There was a sense of urgency. We've got to get them out of here quick, or we're all going to get wiped out. So now in chapter 12, verse 35 and 36, they had been previously told by God, when you leave, I'm going to force them to let you leave. And when you leave, I want you to go to the Egyptians and ask for their silver and gold. Which is amazing, because when you think about, wait a minute, are they really stealing anything? They worked for free for 400 years. And now it's only fitting that they get the big payoff when they leave, right? And so they get all the gold and silver of Egypt, and it ends there in verse 36. It ends with, thus they plundered the Egyptians. Amazing statement. They picked them clean, I think is what it literally says. And so, incredible payback for all the Egyptians for what they've done to Israel. And so now in verse 37, here they are leaving quickly. And you probably heard that on Passover, Israel eats unleavened bread for 7 days. That was to signify, that was a symbol of them having to leave in haste. You know, they couldn't wait for the bread to rise, the leaven to take effect. And so they ate unleavened bread to remember that they urgently had to leave in haste. Now, before I go on, I want you to do one thing with me, participate in this. As we go through this story, try to see all the types. You know what a type is? It's something that happens that's going to foreshadow, foresee Christ and the gospel in the future. Okay? And so as we go through this, you go, well, that's a type of this. Just kind of file it back in here in your brain. And when we come back at the end in the conclusion, we'll go through a bunch of those types, all right? So try to see this whole deal as a type of salvation, a type of the gospel, every little part of the story. So now verse 37, you may ask the question, well, how many Israelites were there? How many left? Well, do the math. We get a pretty good idea here in verse 37. It says there were about 600,000 adult men on foot walking out, aside from children and, of course, women. And not only that, verse 38 says there was a mixed multitude that went with them. So there was a bunch of other peoples, Egyptians and probably various Semitic people, that went out with them for one reason or another. Maybe a lot of them had been slaves with them or whatever. And so they came out with them. So if you just, you know, do a factor for every adult male, if you do 3 women and children and 1 mixed multitude, you're going to come up with close to anywhere from 2 to 3 million people. The point being, there was a lot of them. Think about the difficulties of 3 million people just getting up and trying to leave all together at one time and walk out of there. I mean, you can imagine the column, how long the column would be that they were walking in. A lot of people is the point. And as they leave, you can see, you can skip the rest of that chapter because we're going to come back to the Passover, okay? So when you're saying, well, he didn't explain the Passover. I'm going to come back in a couple of weeks to that, to all do a special deal on the, have you ever wondered about all the different feasts and celebrations of Israel, what they were? They were all given here in Exodus and of course, also Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, the first 5 books is where they all come from. And so we're going to come back and examine all of those later. So skip to chapter 13. Verse 17, here they are coming out, and as they're coming out of Egypt, what would you expect? What are your expectations? What are their expectations? Well, I would expect, what's the shortest distance between 2 points? A direct line, a straight line. So I would expect that they would take a direct route. Which one is it? I would take a direct route to the promised land, that God would take them in the fastest way. And it only makes sense also that you would take the highway that was on the coast. So along the coast of the Mediterranean coast, there was a highway and there were various cities. And so not only would it be the direct route, but you'd be on a highway and you would also be going through cities that had food and water and everything you would need. That's what makes sense to me. And I'm sure that's what they wanted to do. But instead, God had a different plan. He almost always does, doesn't he? And it's always a plan that we can't quite figure it out. Why did that happen? Why is this happening to me? You know, whatever. God's just got a better plan that's more bigger and better than we could even imagine. So God knew that the best way was for them was the long, hard way. The long, hard way through the wilderness is what God knew they really needed. They didn't need the easy way. They needed the hard way. Because their faith would be continuously tested and revealed who they were and what they believed as they went through the wilderness. In Deuteronomy 8, after it's all over, after 40 years, Moses looks back and he's given a sermon to the nation after 40 years, and he says, you want to know what happened there the last 40 years, why you had to do that? God was testing you. He was testing you to know what was in your heart, to see if you would obey. And of course, God knew, but he was revealing to them and to us what was really in the human heart. And we'll see that in just a minute. So the appearances were that, you know, that they're going to go do one thing, but God takes them a different direction. Instead of going up on the coast road, they go the opposite direction into the wilderness. And so you see in verse 17, chapter 13, verse 17, now it came about when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines. That's the coast road. Even though it was near, for God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and they return to Egypt. So lest they get in some trouble there and want to go back. Hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in martial array or organized array from the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph. If you'd studied the book of Genesis, you know, at the end of Genesis, when Joseph died, he had such belief and faith in the promises of God. He said, preserve my bones and take me back to the promised land with you when you go. And so that promise had been passed from generation to generation. And now 400 years later, they actually do that. They take his bones back. And so verse 20, they camped and were told how they were led. In verse 21, the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud. So they see this giant, awesome cloud. And they see the presence of God somehow in that cloud. It's very impressive. And it moves in front of them and they follow it. And at night, it gets even more awesome because they see the glory of God, the Shekinah glory of God, in that cloud, and they're able to even march at night because it illuminates the way. So an incredible revealing of God's presence through the cloud that he was in and let them see. Verse 22, he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night. From before the people, it was always there. They always knew which direction that he wanted them to go by following it. So in chapter 14, verse 1 and 2, they're going to go a certain distance, and then God is going to tell Moses, and the cloud's going to turn and go back. They're going to circle around. They're going to be walking around in circles. Again, that doesn't make sense to the human mind, but God's got a plan. Because he wants them to appear like they're wandering. Look at verse 3. Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly. That sounds like a bad thing. But God, again, God had a plan, wanted them to look like they were wandering aimlessly, like they were lost. And he wanted them to go to a place where they, as it says, would be shut in. And so he's going to take them up to the Red Sea, and they're going to be between two big hills, like mountains, and the Red Sea on their back, and then right in front of them is going to be the Egyptian army. So he's going to put them in sort of a cul-de-sac, you might say, in which they'll be completely trapped. Completely trapped. There's no way out. Have you ever had an unsolvable problem? That's basically what's going on. But they are, problems of life are so well disguised as unsolvable problems. But you know what's interesting? If you have a really good memory, and I know I'm safe here, But if you had a really good memory and could remember back 10 to 15 years ago, you know you were worried about something. You know you were praying about something. You had some problems. But you can't remember what they are now. What happened? Obviously, they were not unsolvable. You solved them. They got solved, right? But the problems of life always seem to be unsolvable. And so God put them in a place that looked like it was unsolvable. There's no way out. There's nowhere to go. We're doomed. And that's what he was doing, wandering around like that. And Pharaoh sees that. His scouts come back and say, God, they're just wandering around in circles. They don't even know where they're going. And now they've camped at a place which is making them vulnerable, and they have no defense. They're trapped. And so now in verse 4, you'll see two forces at work that bring Pharaoh out with his army. And this is that spiritual mystery we've been talking about. You've got both the free will of man and the responsibility of man, but also the sovereignty of God. It's God's sovereign plan that Pharaoh bring his army out to attack them for God's purposes. Because he's got one more time, he's going to reveal himself in the crossing of the Red Sea. And so two things happen. Pharaoh's sitting back there stewing, and he thinks all the plagues are over. And you can imagine how mad he is about his son and all, what has happened to the whole land of Egypt, just being devastated. And he thinks, why did I let those guys go? Who's going to build all the buildings? Who's going to repair all this damage that's been done? We need those people back. So that's one force, his desire to enslave them. And then the other force, we're told, God actually says to Moses, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Now, Pharaoh already wants to harden his heart. So it's not like God is causing him to do something he doesn't want to do, right? But he is going to be a part of that force that brings Pharaoh out with his entire army. And it's kind of, you know, when something bad happens and you think it's over, you kind of return to your old wicked ways, right? You were a choir boy, you know, while you had this big problem and you're praying for God to solve it. But once you get it solved, you go right back. And that's kind of what Pharaoh was doing. And God was actually aiding them because he wanted Pharaoh to come out. So because of those two forces, he has a change of heart, it says. And he says, why did we ever let them go? We need them to serve. Let's go get them. And so you see that they put their army together. He has a change of heart in verse 5. And it tells us that he has 600 chariots of war. Now that's like a Abrams M1A tank, you know. In fact, a funny story, a little kid came home from Sunday school. And they said, what'd you learn at Sunday school today? And he said, well, we learned about the crossing of the Red Sea. Really? What'd they tell you? Well, Moses and the guys had 1,000 M1A Abrams tanks. And they had air cover with F-15 fighters. And they had these rocket launchers. And they, you know, on and on about all this modern warfare. And they wiped all the Egyptians out. And the parents looked at him and said, is that really what they said? He said, no, but if I told you what they said, you wouldn't believe it. Yeah. So they've got 600 chariots, and they were built so as, and heavy horses, they were built to just run right through foot soldiers. And so they were going to charge with 600 of them and just mow them down and wipe them out and take the survivors back to be slaves. So that's what they're looking at. And what is the reaction of Israel? Verse 10, chapter 14, 10. As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. So they see them coming, and they look around, and they go, wait a minute, there's no way out of this. They became very frightened. They started crying out, and they said to Moses, this is unbelievable. Think of what they've been through for the last 400 years. slavery, genocide. And look what they say. Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away and brought us out here into the wilderness? In other words, you brought us out here to die? Is that what this is about? How could you do this? They're very angry. They're very frightened. And they're very angry at Moses and therefore at God. Very much like us when we shake our fist and go, you know, why did you make me like this? Or you say, what have I done to deserve this? I mean, that's basically what they were going, the emotions they were going through here. And so Moses said to the people, here's the man of faith steps forward and he says, do not fear. Stand by. Look at the words here, the commands. Stand by, which means you just stand there and watch what's going to happen. You don't need to do anything. You just stand by and see the salvation of the Lord. See the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you have seen today, you will see them no more forever. And the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. So while you do nothing, the Lord is going to accomplish this salvation. So the Lord said to Moses, why are they crying out? Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. So that's all he asks them to do, is make a step towards the Red Sea. Now, when he commands them to do that, you know, if you and I were there, we'd go, why would we do that? There's nowhere to go. You know, I never got swimming lessons. And, you know, in slavery, they didn't have too many, you know, nice backyard swimming pools, right? So why would I go that way? So they had to step out in faith and go towards the Red Sea, which they did. And then verse 16, God says to Moses, as for you, lift up your staff that he had done those miracles with before, Aaron's staff, and stretch out your hand over the sea, and it will divide at your command, so to speak. And the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. God, now this is a big miracle. This is incredible. And as for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and then I will be honored through Pharaoh. I will get all the glory, in other words, through what Pharaoh and all of his army, as they come in there, and they will be destroyed. Thus the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. There's the purpose statement again. After every miracle, you have that. That's what this is all about, revealing who God is to everybody concerned. And so, you know, when you look at that, you remember the old joke about the kid and the college professor? The college professor says, well, there's a naturalistic explanation for the parting of the Red Sea. We've done some archaeological work, and we're virtually certain that where they crossed, it was only 18 inches deep. And it's a scientific fact that when 60-mile-per-hour winds blow for 10 hours, it can move water at least a mile away, thus creating the effect of dry land that happened. Very naturalistic. So the kid raises his hand and says, so there was 18 inches of water. He said, yeah. So, well, that's a bigger miracle because the whole Egyptian army drowned in 18 inches of water. You know? There is no naturalistic cause. And I read so many commentaries, and a lot of them, you know, always try to put in, well, we think what really happened here, and they put this naturalistic deal. This is a miracle. There's nothing natural about it. There is no naturalistic cause. God did this, and he did it at his command. When you hold this up, this will happen. And when you hold it up again, it'll close back. It's a miracle. The text makes that clear that it is. And God will be glorified. And so in verse 20 there, you can see that the first thing that happens so that Israel will have time to walk across, the first thing that happens is that pillar of cloud in which God had been leading them went around behind them between the Egyptians and Israel. So it acted as a wall between the Egyptian army and Israel so that they couldn't get them until the proper time that God had ordained. So they're able to walk across on dry land as the waters are parted there. And then in verse 21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all day and night, turned the sea into dry land, so the waters were divided. And verse 21 says it was like a wall on each side, the sea was. So it wasn't any naturalistic deal. It was God was holding it back on their right hand and on their left. And then verse 23, when the Egyptians took up pursuit, he and all his horses and his chariots and the whole deal went in after them in the midst of where the sea had been. They said, if they can do it, we can do it. So they chased them in there. And it came about at the morning watch that the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. So the first thing that happened, they went out there, and I don't know if because the cloud descended upon them or God just messed them up, disoriented them, but they started running into each other, and the wheels started coming off, and a very wild scene, driving with difficulty, it says. And so much so that they said, let us flee, let us get out of here quickly, for the Lord is fighting for Israel against the Egyptians. And at that point, verse 26, the Lord says to Moses, stretch out your hand again, and the sea will come back and drown them. So he did, and they stood up there. Imagine being one of the Israelites standing up there, having crossed. You've walked up on the higher ground, and you're looking down where the sea had been to the Egyptian army coming, and then the waters just come right back down on them. And you see all the bodies float up, all the dead soldiers. They see that, and it's such an awesome, incredible sight. So verse 30, it says, thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. So the great results, I mean, they are like, wow, we believed in you before, but now our belief is reinforced big time, and we have this incredible reverence and awe for this all-powerful God that just saved us and wiped out the Egyptians. Real quick, 5 minutes, how big a miracle was it? Well, don't forget, there's 3 million people. 3 million people walking out of there that have got to cross the Red Sea. Think of the logistics of that. 3 million marched in pairs like they did in the Charlton Heston movie. The line of people would be 800 miles long. So that isn't what happened. And it would take, you know, like 35 days to cross the Red Sea. So if you do the math, I think you'll come up with something like they had to be around 5,000 across, walking across the Red Sea to get over in one day, which is what they did. And then not only that, once they get across, they're going to be in the wilderness, they're going to be in the desert, and you'll see it in a minute, but now how are you going to feed and water 3 million people in the desert, in the Sinai Desert? Their problems are just beginning, it looks like to me. And even if you had the water, and even if you had the food, think of the distribution problems. Distribution. How are you going to get it to everybody in time before they starve to death? Well, in chapter 15, it's basically a poem that they probably set to music of their praising and worshiping God. But then in verse 22, chapter 15, verse 22, after all the praising of God, that lasted just a couple of days, by the way. When they walked out of there and they got into the wilderness, into the desert, all of a sudden, they're thirsty. They're thirsty. So the minute they have to go through some hardship and trouble, verse 24 says, they began grumbling and complaining. You brought us out here without any water? Where's the water? And verse 25, God tests them. So this whole thing is a test of their faith. This whole wilderness experience, and it will be for the next 40 years. God's going to continuously test their faith. And in chapter 16 and 17, is you've got three things going on in chapter 16 and 17. First, you've got people grumbling, and they're complaining about water, and about, then again in chapter 16 about food, and then chapter 17 back complaining about the taste of the water. It's bitter. And so you've got the grumbling and the complaining of the people. And then the second thing is God providing. What's he going to do? At sundown, he's going to send these big flocks of quail to come in there. And in my imagination, I can see him standing there with tennis rackets, just bap, bap, knocking the quail down, you know, to cook for dinner. And then in the morning when they wake up, there's going to be this strange dew on the ground all across the camp. And it's going to turn into this type of heavenly bread that God's going to provide. So think of the distribution of the food. It comes to them. The quail fly into the camp to wherever they are. The bread appears all across the camp. So the distribution problem is solved. The food problem is solved. The water problem is going to be solved in chapter 17. They're going to say, okay, well, that food's pretty good, but what about the water? So God tells Moses to walk up and hit this rock with his staff, and literally a river is going to come out of it and flow all the way through the camp. So again, plenty of water, and the distribution is solved by the river coming all the way through of water. The miracles of God, his providing them everything they need. And then from that point on, they will continuously be tested by all these things. Because once they've eaten the manna and the quail for, you know, 6 weeks, 45 days it says, actually, they're going to start complaining about that. You know, when we were back in Egypt, we had a real variety of food. We had fish and we had garlic and we had all kinds of spices and different things. Now we're stuck out here with nothing but this bread and this meat. This is awful. So they're going to continue, and God's going to continue to test them every step of the way. And one of the funny things to me is when they first realize that all that stuff on the ground is bread, and they gather it up, and God says, I just want you to gather up every day. I want you to gather up just enough for one day. Don't gather more, because if you do, I'll govern this by spoilage. It'll rot. So just get up. Gather up just enough. So they go out and gather it up and they eat it just like they were commanded. And you know what they said? What is it? What is it? And you've heard the word manna? That's what that means in Hebrew. What is it? So every day they'd get up and have some what is it? And you know what that tells you? They didn't grow this. They didn't harvest it. They didn't make the bread. God provided it completely. God's provision to them. And so God tests his people, and then he provides for them. And we're told in 1 Corinthians 10, by the way, he recaps the story of wandering in the wilderness and all the stuff they went to. This is Paul writing to the church. And Paul says the church's experience is very much like Israel in the wilderness, with all the trouble and the persecution and all the problems of life that they face. They're having, the church is having its own desert experience. And so Paul warns them. He says, don't rebel as they did. Don't grumble and complain as they did. Fortunately, none of us complain or grumble or whine about anything. You're supposed to go, well, we wish. But that's Paul's warning. You know, don't go too far on that, because you believe in God and you believe God's going to take care of you. So live by faith, just like they had to. And when you do that, what are you doing? Your focus is not on the troubles that you're going through, the problems that you have, as much as where you're going. So it's not as much on where you are at this point in time. your real focus, spiritual perspective would be a better term, is on what the future holds, the future promises of God. So I'm not focused here as I am, as where I'm going to, which is what? The promised land. To us, the promised land, of course, is heaven. To them in this story, it's the land of Canaan when they're going to get their own land. So very much same type situation for the church that they went through. And we said earlier, we're going to come back. I barely made it. We're going to come back to this idea of types. When you think of the Passover, what is that a type of? Of course, it's the judgment, but then the Passover lamb, the sacrificial, vicarious blood of the lamb that saved them from being wiped out, of course, is a type of Christ. The blood of the lamb is a type of the sacrifice of Christ. The Israelites wandering and getting trapped is just like us living in this fallen, evil world. We got to wander around in it, and we got all these problems and all this trouble and all the evil that exists in the world. And we cry out for help, just like they did. Lord, get me out of this. Help me in the same way. And then the grace of God, the gift of God in taking care of Israel, parting the Red Sea, providing all the manna and the food, the whole deal. What did he first say there at the Red Sea? Stand by and watch. What about our salvation? Do we work it out? Do we accomplish it? No. Same deal. Stand by and watch what Christ is going to do. He's going to get on that cross and die for you so that you can be forgiven and have eternal life. Isn't that awesome? It's the same thing that happened at the Red Sea. And what's the purpose statement in all this? That God may be glorified. That's our purpose in life. That's why God created us, to glorify Him and serve Him in a loving relationship. And so our reaction needs to be, which is what happened to them, it says, after the parting of the Red Sea, what did they do? They believed. They believed. And that was a type of our belief. We see what Jesus did, and we believe. Same thing. And then, but still, we got to continue to live. And even after the Red Sea, crossing the Red Sea, what did they have to do? They had to continue to go forward and live on their wilderness experience with all their thirst and their hunger and their problems. Same with us. But we now depend on, they had the pillar of cloud and the glory of God leading them, and we have, being in the church, we have the Spirit of God in us, leading us, guiding us, teaching us. Isn't that awesome? We got a long, hard road that we got to travel before we get there. But we've got the Spirit of God leading us, just as they did. Well, we made it. 104. And then next week, we're going to go through, don't miss it, we're going to talk about something I call a little red book that I hope you have. You may have read it, and I know a lot of you have. The Red Sea Rules, I think, is next week, if I'm thinking right. Isn't that what it says on the deal? Yeah, next week, the Red Sea Rules, which I think you'll really enjoy, so don't miss that. Let me close in prayer. Lord, thank you so much for blessing us with these stories, how awesome they are, how big a miracle it was. But Lord, it's no bigger than the work of Christ on the cross that saved us from our sin and is taking us to our promised land. And we pray in Jesus' name, amen.